For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Alison MacLeod reimagines the circumstances surrounding the writing and suppression of Lady Chatterley's Lover. We celebrate National Poetry Day with the world exclusive from The Blind Poet. And Lisa Hall takes us to Britain's most haunted village and introduces us to the woman in the woods. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence is one of the most notorious novels ever written and was banned on both sides of the Atlantic for many years under obscenity laws. In her latest novel, Tenderness, Alison MacLeod weaves together fact and fiction to reimagine the events that inspired Lawrence to write Chatterley and to re-examine the fault lines in 20th century Western culture that its publication and banning exposed. Alison MacLeod, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red. Thanks very much for having me.
The book begins with Lawrence dying in the south of France and drifting in and out of consciousness as he recalls the meeting with the woman who inspired him to write Lady Chatterley. And I think not everybody will know that there really was a Constance Chatterley in Lawrence's life.
Yes, that's the case. And I was myself quite surprised, delighted, intrigued to discover that. I had long known the novel Lady Chatterley's Lover since my teens, but I had, I suppose like many people, assumed that if any woman had been the model, well, it's usually said that that was Frieda Lawrence, and it makes a level of sense, of course it does, in that she was a sort of well-born woman. She was the daughter of a German baron, and Lawrence was at the time of their first great meeting, their first great passion. Lawrence was, you know, a working class teacher who had done well for himself by becoming a school teacher. He was the son of a coal miner. So I thought, well, naturally, yes. And Lady Chatterley, the novel, has been called a love letter to Frieda Lawrence. So I more or less stopped with that notion and assumed that was the case. And it was only really in digging deep into the research of the last 6 years that I came across, by distant reference through an obituary, and then it was a sort of detective story that unfolded for me, that took me to the real life figure of a woman called Rosalind Thornycroft Baines. And she was the upper middle class, very much of the leisured classes. She was the daughter of a royal academician. And Lawrence had his only extramarital affair of life with Rosalind Baines, who was on the brink of divorce. And he had that relationship with her for 2 to 3 weeks in September 1920. And that relationship initially inspired this tremendous sequence of incredibly rich poems, erotic poems, but more than that, from a 1922 collection. And he ended the relationship, although it's clear that she was in a vulnerable state. She was on the brink of divorce with 3 children, and she was elated by the relationship. He then decided to commit to his marriage, and perhaps had always intended to. But her story is very little explored, and I thought, gosh, especially when I read those poems, I then realized how her description still was with him, her lovely appearance, all sorts of details of her life, then informed the writing of Lady Chatterley's Lover, his last novel, after he'd given her up 6 years before. She was still with him, still very much moving him and inspiring him, and she formed the model for Constance Chatterley as he began to write in 1926.
And one of the strands of the story is therefore us revisiting when Lawrence first saw Rosalind Baines, and then when he and she spent time together. And we see that she is a woman who is trapped in a marriage by the expectations of what a society wife should be.
and deeply unhappy, and like Lady Chatterley, feels a physical gap in her life. And that is picked up in the story of Jackie Kennedy, who forms another strand of this novel. The difference between what is expected of women and what women might want to feel for themselves hasn't changed much between 1930 and 1959 when we joined Jackie Kennedy.
No, that's so well put, Red. I don't think it really had. And I think some women would say they suffer from those constraints even in the 21st century, which is why I think I found the story of Lady Chatterley on rereading still so moving, because she's so daring in her own time, so sort of quietly daring, little by little, asserting her need not just for sort of sexual fulfillment, which is subsequently how it was portrayed and the source of scandal, but in wanting a sort of genuine sense of emotional, even spiritual connection with another human being, and all of that being part and parcel of the one experience. And of course, Lady Chatterley is married to a baronet, Sir Clifford. She was the mistress of Ragby Hall, and she more or less, by the end of the novel, in society terms, would have been said to have bolted from her duties without producing an heir. I mean, I think Lawrence was so bold because he could have much more readily made us immediately sympathetic to Constance Chatterley if we knew, say, her husband was really promiscuous. And that was the case for Rosalind Baines in real life. But Lawrence did something in the transformation into fiction that I think is far more interesting. He really made it difficult for himself because, of course, he wants us to feel for and perhaps even to fall in love, as he had, with his character of Constance Chatterley. But she's struggling in her marriage and subsequently unfaithful in her marriage to a man who was paralyzed in what then, of course, was called the Great War. So he was a war hero. He came back, like so many men of his generation, maimed in midlife, living from a motorized wheelchair or bath chair, as it was sometimes called. And so if you think about that from Lawrence's point of view, writing that, he could have been so much easier on himself and given Lady Chatterley, as they say, a sort of cad of a husband. But he doesn't. We don't warm to Clifford as things go on, because we discover that Lawrence is by no means down on anyone with what we might call a disability or a struggle in that sense today. So he's in no way minimizing that state, but instead I think he's trying to create, whether we agree with it or not, a metaphor for a man who is spiritually paralyzed, and hence Constance Chatterley struggles to thrive in that marriage because her husband is spiritually sterile as well as physically sterile.
And in the case of Jackie Kennedy, her husband, JFK, has a very debilitating back injury from his service in the Second World War. And he is philandering. And Jackie, even from when she was at school, her declared ambition was not to become a housewife. And yet she is stuck as the young wife of a promising senator. She herself is emotionally stagnant.
Yes, she was certainly struggling. I mean, I followed through in considerable detail the biographical research for Jackie Kennedy just in that particular slot of time in the 50s, but particularly the late 50s, when she is just on the cusp of becoming First Lady. And as you say, she did have this huge ambition when she was younger, both to write fiction. She also painted, and she studied in Paris at the Sorbonne. She loved French literature. She wanted to write. She was very creative. She sort of broke through and became a junior journalist when that often wasn't the role for women at the time. So she did have ambitions, and she said that she thought, for example, the title of First Lady was just something, you know, that she found quite risible, something she didn't really want attached to her. I think she almost associated it with first housewife of the nation, first housewife to the White House. And yet, that was her future. And they were on it really as a couple. In those years, he'd gone through really knife-edge back surgery, really touch and go with whether he would survive that back surgery. He was also developing Addison's disease, and that was taking more and more of a hold. And she herself was wrestling with her growing role. She's actually quite a shy individual, according to all accounts. So I felt it was not surprising when I thought about who might be reading Lady Chatterley in 1959, 1960, the time when publishers on two sides of the Atlantic wanted to release the uncut version to us as readers. And you know, that was, as we all know now, but from the 1960 obscenity trial, was no mean feat. It caused huge scandal even in 1960. So I just had a hunch. I thought, I just knowing enough about Jackie Kennedy's biography, about the difficulties. At one point, they had agreed that they would divorce if he didn't win the 1960 nomination, because she felt humiliated by his known philandering. And yet, of course, he did win the Democratic nomination. And perhaps things did ease with the birth of Caroline in some respects. It didn't totally. But they did hit a really dark period after the miscarriage that Jackie suffered with an earlier child. So it was quite a dark, lonely period in many senses that we don't really recognize. And yet she was relatively anonymous at this time. He was growing in renown and respect and sheer, you know, PR appeal. She was just coming into that herself, and I loved being able to go back and investigate a life we think we know so well.
And you imagine that this search for some kind of release, some kind of empathetic understanding of her position, leads her to the trial of whether the post office in the United States is breaking the law by distributing Lady Chatterley's Lover in 1959. And that, in turn, causes her to fall foul of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. And there's a wonderful spy story cat and mouse going on within this novel as well.
Yes, I love that description. There absolutely is. And in fact, as you can imagine, and as you've alluded to yourself, Red, there were so many strands of research, and that's why it was an epic research project for me. But the very first thing that told me instinctively that I had a novel on my hands was the irresistible discovery of the fact that the FBI was following the fate of the publication of Lady Chatterley's Lover. And that began in 1959, or even possibly just prior, when Grove Press in New York decided, actually before Penguin, to publish the unexpurgated version. And the FBI had already been following and gathering a huge file on the publisher Barney Rossett for his iconoclastic, and in American terms of the time, his un-American publishing taste. So he was known for publishing provocateurs and European avant-garde writers. He had quite the list, much of which we respect and call diverse today. But at the time, for the FBI, he was regarded, and he was absolutely listed, as a subversive, along, incidentally, with about close to 400,000 other American citizens, including congressmen, senators, and their families, who were being watched as a direct part of policy for the FBI at the time to actually surveil, monitor covertly members of the Senate, members of the Congress. So it was the discovery of a telegram that Hoover had written in 1959 asking a sufficiently distant FBI office in Chicago, so distant from Washington. He didn't want any of this coming back or anyone picking up the trail. But he asked that office to locate a copy of the Grove Press new publication of the uncut Lady Chatterley. and Hoover through the FBI and other cables are directly from Hoover, asking for a copy of that to be sent to Washington so it could be analyzed by a division of the Bureau, which was called the Lab. And the Lab was to assess its degree of so-called obscenity. But we more or less know that that wasn't an assessment, but rather a finding that Hoover wanted found. He wanted that book to be found guilty because he wanted the Bureau to have reason to hound and to shut down Grove Press. So Hoover and the FBI actually follow the fate of Lady Chatterley, you could say, all the way to London and to the Penguin famous trial. And we find that in 1960, they're from a distance and discreetly, but nevertheless, offering assistance to the prosecution team. All of that's accurate. So when I knew that Hoover was on the case of Lady Chatterley in really quite a sinister way, I then found myself thinking, right, this book is causing almost a kind of incoming surge tide into culture and society. Who else might have been aware in 1959 of things afoot with Lady Chatterley and the uncut version? Who else might have been interested in that? Who else might have even known about it? And I thought, I wonder, Jackie Kennedy, so literate, so interested in literature, art, had wanted to write, a former reporter herself. And I thought, if we know that she's read it, well, it's actually mirroring her own life quite strangely at that time. Or there's certain parallels that I'm sure she could only have found sympathetic. It was a hunch, and I didn't know if it was more than that. And between us, because I think fiction allows us, if we, one might alter a certain fact to show a wider truth. And I really wanted to show the truth of what was going on with so-called un-American activity in the States at that time and the monitoring of congressmen by the FBI. So I might have allowed myself to do it anyway. But what I then discovered was just for me a small miracle as a writer that Jackie Kennedy, just 18 months after the Penguin trial, had been at an official reception in the White House when Jack Kennedy was now president. They had a large state dinner for the Nobel Prize winners, but she invited particularly six personal guests to join them upstairs in the Oval Room after the party. It was sort of a private gathering and really intimate. And one of those people was Lionel Trilling, a critic who absolutely championed D.H. Lawrence. And they then sat down, apparently for about an hour and a half, and had a long and close tete-a-tete about the novels of D.H. Lawrence. So then I thought, my hunch wasn't really so far misplaced. And I just predated that meeting with that critic. I moved backwards by about 2 years and imagine what their conversation might have been like.
Now, the poet Philip Larkin famously said that the success of the Lady Chatterley publication trial helped usher in the sexual revolution. But Lawrence remains a very controversial figure for many feminists. Where do you stand on his view and treatment of women?
Well, it's such a good question, and it's beautifully complex, but I'll try not to be. The trial, and it's the vindication of the book, made him a kind of celebrity. And this is where Larkin comes in saying, you know, the sexual revolution, which began a bit late for me, somewhere between the end of the Chatterley ban and the first Beatles LP, I think is how it goes. So he was in that wave of new liberation and a new openness. And it was seen then that Lawrence was incredibly daring in bringing the human body and all of its vulnerability and shames and triumphs onto the prose page, which is complete honesty in many views of the period. Then 1970 is the key thing, and it's a key thing for my generation of readers of all kinds, and for women and for feminists in particular, of which I count myself one, absolutely. I was at university. He was effectively, let's say, in today's parlance, he was cancelled. And I felt sadness about that. One didn't feel one could quite share an interest in him. And he was cancelled primarily because it was felt that he made women into the mere love object and the lesser beings of male sexual desire, and also that he represented the female body in some ways quite crudely. You could say he gets some bits of the female sexual experience wrong. He's a bit gauche. Not doing badly, I don't think, from 1928, when these things really weren't spoken of and bits of the body weren't really fully understood. But he was, once again, a scandal for those reasons. And so that's what he was interrogated for and criticized for by Kate Millett in 1970 in her work, Sexual Politics. But women of my age, I now find it very interesting. Those of us who grew up loving Lawrence, but then discovered Lawrence was not deemed acceptable for us to read, and have always perhaps felt the injustice of that. While I think Kate Millett's argument absolutely needed to happen, I do feel myself, as a writer, as a woman, as a feminist, as a lover of literature, that Lawrence, it seems so ironic, there are very few male writers who write female consciousness with as much insight, as much, I'll use the word love, as much dedication, certainly, as Lawrence does. His female characters in so many of his novels are the mainstays of his fiction, and very, very few men even now still attempt to render female consciousness on the page in as nuanced a way as Lawrence does. His mother was a great figure for him. Frieda was a great figure for him. He had great complicated relationships with women, but he was very much a man who was female influenced, and that shows throughout his work. So I think myself and other women today are, you could say, reevaluating the reevaluation and thinking, no, actually, he was a huge inspiration for us.
And of course, Chatterley is far from a wham bam thank you ma'am type novel. It's actually a very slow burgeoning of a relationship between Mellors and Lady Chatterley, and its original title was Tenderness, which of course you've chosen for your own book. There's an understanding that relationships have to grow in Lawrence.
Absolutely. It's complicated between Oliver Mellors, the gamekeeper, and Lady Chatterley. And it's by no means this sort of sensational sweep into bed or into the wood for sex. And Lawrence himself was adamant that it was not what he called a sex novel. He actually considered himself a Puritan, maybe in the old sense of the word, in that a Puritan is someone who lives by his conscience. He writes the body, as few other people in his time had. So he's not a prude, but he is a person who believes passionately in, you could say, almost this sort of mythic sacredness or the elemental sacredness of unions of love. And that's, for Lawrence, that is also the means through which society heals itself. And that was never more important, perhaps, than for his generation in the wake of the First World War, when the country came through traumatized, absolutely traumatized, from the shock of the scale of defeats of that war and from the maimed and broken men who returned from it and from, of course, the millions who did not return. Lawrence, he's not a pacifist, but he was absolutely against that war because he felt it took war beyond what he thought could be the natural defense of one's nation, one's principles, to industrial scale slaughter of men. Men, he said, made into machine parts. So that war brought on a huge depression, probably a nervous breakdown for Lawrence in 1914 to 1915. That's, in a sense, in that year with that depression. And it's also the year he became acquainted with the circle of people who would introduce him to Rosalind Baines. Many things happen in that year that then go on later in life to feed into and influence, to shape his last novel, Lady Chatterley.
The book has been brought wonderfully to life by the fantastic Antonia Beamish, who is a wonderful narrator. Did you have anything to do with her selection?
I did a little, in that she had narrated my last novel, Unexploded, and when it came time to think about who might be wonderful to do Tenderness, I went back, I listened to that, and I listened to some other things that Antonia has done, and I just thought she is impeccable.
Readers are keepers of secrets. As an illicit page is turned, as a dangerous truth is inferred, the pulse quickens. Something explosive ticks between the lines. There is an intake of breath, the voyeur's silent flare of recognition. All the while, his or her face is impassive, unremarkable even, because, like all subversives, readers lead careful double lives.
Antonia Beamish, narrating Tenderness, written by my guest, Alison MacLeod.
Well, it is a wonderful, vibrant story, very thought-provoking and beautifully written. Alison MacLeod, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Tenderness, and I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
I'd love that, Red. Thanks very much.
Tenderness is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. And Alison MacLeod will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Lisa Hall reveals a penchant for spooky houses and herbal remedies as she takes us deep into the woods to explore her new psychological thriller. But first...
Dave Steele is the blind poet. Through his collections of verse, Stand By Me, RP, he's helped bring solace and understanding about sight loss to thousands of BVI people and their families worldwide. So he's the ideal person to talk to on this National Poetry Day. Dave, welcome back. And I believe you've got a really exciting announcement about a book in verse.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, but my first children's book, which is going to be the first of a new series, will be launching this month, and it's available now to pre-order via my website, and it's called Austin's Amazing Adventures.
This series has been inspired by your experiences and your son as well.
Yeah, it's strange the way it kind of came about. It actually started a couple of years ago when I saw an article, I think it was in The Guardian, by the children's author Julia Donaldson, who you may know did The Gruffalo and Stickman and Room on a Broom and lots of amazing children's stories that are all written in that poetic style. And I've been reading these books to my son Austin since he was 2 years old. We do Facebook Live bedtime stories every night, and we'd read these stories because I can memorize these poetic stories. So when I'm unable to see the words in the text that's on the page, I'm able to kind of read them without actually having to read them as such. And Julia Donaldson was talking about how there needs to be more children with disabilities featured in children's stories. And when I read that article, it sparked something in me. And in the first night after reading that article, I wrote the first 6 books of this new children's series. And it's about a young visually impaired boy based on my son, Austin, who is not visually impaired at the moment, but he has a 1 in 2 chance of losing his sight when he's older due to the retinitis pigmentosa that I have. And in the story, he's a young visually impaired boy losing his sight from the age of 5. He has his best friend when he's a little bit older in the story, who's his guide dog. And it's about a young visually impaired boy going to a mainstream school and all the challenges and things that he goes through on a day-to-day basis. And this whole idea is about normalizing low vision and blindness and disability so that other children understand that kids with disabilities and low vision and blindness are just like them. And also those children that are living with these conditions, it gives them a character they can really identify with and relate to.
And the books have been illustrated, and there is also an audiobook version, I believe.
That's correct. In fact, the audiobook version is actually going to be given free as a download with every purchase from my website of the books, so we can make them truly accessible. We hope to have a Braille version in the future as well, very shortly. We're currently working on that at the moment. These books are really about trying to get them in the hands of as many children and schools as possible, because what we've done as well is at the end of each story, there is what we call a section of open-ended questions, talking points, guided learning. So these are questions about the story that the child has just read, and it encourages children to put themselves in the shoes of Austin in the story and talk about how they would feel in certain situations. And these books actually can be used as part of a lesson within schools as well. So, you know, we're really hoping that a lot of schools will use these as part of the lessons.
For schools and also individuals who are interested in pre-ordering a copy, where do they go?
They can just go to my website, which is theblindpoet.net, and all the information's on there. There's lots of great videos and stuff like that talking about the books. And obviously the website's fully accessible as well to anyone who is unable to read text.
And regular listeners will, of course, know that I never get you onto the show without asking you to read something. So if possible, could we have a sneak preview of Austin's Amazing Adventures, please?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a world exclusive, never been read before anywhere. So it's an absolute pleasure to read the opening of this book just for you guys. So here we go. In a little town not far from here, there's a boy that you might know. His name is Austin Steele, and his guide dog friend named Joe. Each day they take adventures as they travel around the world. And here within these pages is how their story first unfurled. When Austin was just 5, his sight began to disappear. But like his dad, he wasn't sad and felt no need to fear. For Austin's dad had shown him that the vision in his mind could overcome the obstacles of slowly going blind. His tunnel view was shrinking, independence getting tough. Some days the outside world felt far too hard, he'd had enough. But with a paw, what once unsure became a strength to grow, returning pride for by his side a friend in guide dog Joe. Now Austin feels amazing, and he knows that he can be absolutely anything despite what he can't see. For with the little he has left, each day is filled with pride. The busy places once had feared, with Joe no longer shied. Though people stare, they couldn't care, just smile and say hello to Austin Steele and his best friend, his guide dog, who's named Joe.
That's a wonderful and empowering message, and one that people need to learn as early in life as possible. So perfect for school-aged children and their parents.
I mean, that's what it's all about. It really is about helping those kids to be a little bit more understood and break down those kind of barriers. And I really have this idea of, as these stories kind of progress, we're going to have it like any kind of mainstream school, where you'll have different children facing different challenges. We'll tackle things like autism, wheelchair use, and the possibilities with this of really breaking down lots of social barriers for disabilities in general is something really exciting.
Well, Dave Steele, I hope it becomes an instant bestseller and classic.
Thanks, Red. Thanks for having me.
For more information about Dave Steele and his wonderful books, go to theblindpoet.net.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Start your day with a morning adventure every weekday from 8 a.m.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
A book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
And our usual talking book slot every weekday at 2 p.m. or if you prefer a book at bedtime, it's repeated at 10 p.m. And you'll find many episodes online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Alison MacLeod to share the books of her life, as a child, Lisa Hall dreamed of being a writer. And with a slew of best-selling psychological thrillers under her belt, it's safe to say that her dream has come true. With the publication of her latest spine-tingling novel, The Woman in the Woods, I dared to invite her onto the show.
Lisa Hall, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
So I was up late last night and actually then couldn't go to sleep because you'd given me the creeps with The Woman in the Woods. For anybody who hasn't picked up the audiobook version yet, could you introduce us to the plot?
Yeah, well, it's the story of a new mother, Ali. She has a toddler and she's got a new baby, and her and her husband have moved into a cottage in Pluckley, which is known as one of the most haunted villages in Britain, certainly the most haunted village in Kent. And she's a little bit sleep deprived. She's a little bit isolated. Her best friend lives in the village, but she doesn't have a huge circle around her. And strange things start to happen in the house. And Ali isn't too sure if there is somebody actually physically messing with her mind or if there is something attached to her house. There is a legend attached to her house of a witch from the 1600s. And there is a story that, you know, Agnes Gowdy is still around and she haunts the cottage. So, yeah, it's really a story about motherhood and mental health and superstition and truth, really.
And it is very important that she has recently given birth just 4 weeks ago. And the suspicion, which even crosses her husband's mind, is that maybe she is suffering from postpartum depression and her mind is playing tricks on her. But we as readers know that there is something a lot more dark going on.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think when you are a new mother, because I've got three children, I mean, they're all teenagers now, but I still remember those days of feeling quite isolated. The new days, you know, when you just bring them home and you do feel quite isolated and you are very, very tired. And sometimes it is difficult to establish what's real and what's not. And of course, Ali's in this cottage with this legend attached to it, which kind of heightens everything. Living in a village where there are a lot of superstitions, you know, Pluckley is a real place and it really is haunted, and there are a lot of stories attached to the village, so there is that whole other layer to the story, not just this idea of, or maybe she's going a bit mad, maybe she is depressed. So yeah, it was quite, I wouldn't like to say fun to write, because it wasn't fun. It was obviously quite draining at times, but it was quite fun to have that whole extra layer to add to the story.
And you reinforce that idea that she might not have bonded with her son by her constantly referring to him as the baby, even though we know he's called Leo because that's what his dad calls him. And that creates that distance between her and her child.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of research about postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis. I mean, I was quite lucky. I had baby blues, like most new mums, but I have a very supportive family, very supportive husband, and I was fine. But there are lots of women out there that aren't fine. Even for mums who don't experience postpartum depression, that bond that everyone talks about, that instant bond, it's not always there for every single woman. And if things don't feel quite right, then obviously it is very hard for the new mum to connect with the baby. And the fact that, like you say, like Ali refers to him as the baby, it does give that sense of distance, that acknowledgement that she hasn't perhaps bonded with him the way that other people would have expected.
There's a real Blair Witch Project type of feeling to this book. And the house itself is a major character. It's not comfortable to be in, even as a reader.
No, I mean, the house is a real house. I found a house in Pluckley that from the outside, I thought, this is my house. This is where she lives. Obviously, the inside of the house is all my imagination because I couldn't really knock on the door and ask to be let in to have a look around. But I really enjoyed setting up the house as another character. So I've not ever really had the opportunity to do that before in any of my other books. So it was quite fun. And I mean, in my own house is not terribly old, but we live on an old watercress farm. And we very often have the feeling that there is something in our house, not something as awful as Agnes Gowdy or anything, but there is still that air on the landing sometimes, as if someone's just left And I did actually see a psychic, and she told me that one of the old farmhands is still hanging around our house, apparently. But he's friendly, so it's all good. So those feelings that I have sometimes of eyes on me in the hallway when there's no one else in the house, I could use that and transfer that onto Ali to show how she was feeling. So it was fun.
I was going to ask, because your own situation in a village in rural Kent, in a house that by your own admission is in need of quite a lot of work, does really lend itself to the plot of The Woman in the Woods.
Yeah, there is always a sense, I think, people say, write what you know. And I think that has come through in this book. Obviously, our house was quite old. We've moved into it. We've done renovations. And my mum actually lives in the next door village to Pluckley. So I've driven past so many times. And the initial seed of the idea was just this woman has this vision that something awful is going to happen to her children, but she doesn't know the full circumstances. And then I was driving to see my mum, and I drove past Pluckley, and I thought, that's where it needs to be. And then that kind of gave me the idea of, is what Ali's seeing or dreaming about, could it not be her own actions? Could it be an echo of the past, or, you know, a memory, an imprint left from the past? And that the whole story came from there. But obviously, living where I live and in the work I've done on this house, it all kind of lended itself to the story, which was quite nice.
And that sense of claustrophobia and creeping peril did make me wonder whether you'd written this during lockdown.
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, I did. But I wasn't being stalked by ghosts.
Your fans all know you as a psychological thriller writer who specialises in domestic noir. And I was fascinated by your moving towards the witchcraft, the kind of more Stephen King and C.J. Tudor territory. Did you enjoy doing the research into the supernatural?
Oh, I loved it. I love anything to do with stuff like that, anything at all. I find it really fascinating. First of all, I find it fascinating that, you know, 300 or 400 years ago, we were being burnt at the stake just for trying to help people. If people were feeling poorly, give them some medicine, on the next minute you're being burnt or drowned. And then I've always been fascinated with the idea that when we die, we don't just go in the ground. There's something more. I like to think there's something more. I know lots of people don't necessarily think like that. So to do the research, and especially looking into the legends and stories that are already attached to Pluckley, I found it really, really fascinating.
And the book is full of references and knowledge about herbs and plants that, as you say, quite ordinary women were giving to friends and family to help them get better. You must have done a massive amount of research on that too.
I did, yeah. I do have quite a few books on poisons and herbal healing plants. My husband's a little bit worried, I think. And I'm lucky that I have a couple of friends that are actually florists. So I could speak to them and say, but what is the meaning behind this flower? And if I wanted to express this, what's the best plant to use? That a lot of the herbs and plants that they used 300 or 400 years ago, they still use now. You know, we still use a lavender pillow spray now to help us get to sleep. So even though a lot of the stuff with regards to Agnes and the gardens are all from the 1600s, it's all still very relevant today.
And are we going to see you moving in the future towards the more supernatural, or was this a one-off?
I'm not too sure. I really, really enjoyed writing it. I mean, the one that I'm working on now is more in my usual vein. There's nothing supernatural to it. But I wouldn't like to say never, because I did really enjoy it. And I think there's so much more you can write about. When you add that layer, there's so many more directions you can take it in.
The book has been brought wonderfully to life as an audiobook by Harry Dobby. You obviously must be delighted that your books are reaching an audience of people who are print disabled.
Oh, I'm absolutely thrilled. Absolutely thrilled. I think books are such an amazing escape from real life, and especially the 18 months that we've all just lived through. If ever a time we needed to escape from real life, it's been in the last 18 months. And I just think everyone deserves that opportunity. So I think it's absolutely amazing to have all my books out as audiobooks. And Harry's done such an amazing job of portraying Ali. She's how I imagined her in my head.
My heart hammers in my chest, so hard that I can barely breathe as I glance up at the landing, the stairs and mountain to climb before me. I fight against the tightness in my chest, against the nausea that makes saliva flood my mouth, and I step forward onto the first step, teetering on the edge. It's as if there is a voice whispering in my ear, telling me there's still time. I can take my foot off the step, lay it back on the solid floor, and then turn and run. Or I can raise the other foot, take another step towards the inevitable. There is a roaring sound in my ears, similar to the noise you hear when you raise a shell to your ear to hear the crashing of the ocean. I can still feel the creak of the stairs underfoot, even if I can't hear it, as I raise first one foot, then the other, climbing towards the top. By allowing myself to climb those stairs, I have made my decision. There can be no going back, not now.
Harry Dobby, narrating The Woman in the Woods, written by my guest, Lisa Hall.
Now, thanks to your publisher, HarperCollins, all your books are available from the R&IB Talking Books Library. Are you a fan of talking books yourself?
I love them. I do like a paperback of an evening with a cup of tea before I go to bed. But when I'm driving, I listen to audiobooks all the time. Even if it's just to pick the kids up from school, I do a quick 10-minute blast. If it's really, really good, while I'm ironing, while I'm cleaning, it just makes the time go quicker.
And I know that as a child, you always dreamed of becoming an author. How difficult was it for you to turn that dream into reality?
Well, to be honest, I sound a bit smug, but it wasn't as difficult as I thought it was going to be. My children were at the age where my youngest was in the final years of primary school, and they didn't need me as much. I had a little bit more time, and I said to my husband, I've got an idea, and I did kind of harp on about it a little bit, to be honest. And in the end, he said, will you please just sit down and write it? Even if you don't do anything with it, just write it. So I wrote the first draft of what would eventually become Between You and Me. And I was on the way home from France. I'd finished the first draft in France on holiday. And we were driving home and I was reading my Kindle. And at the end of the book, there was a little note from the publishers saying that they had open submissions. And it kind of felt like a sign. So I polished it up and I sent it to them and I sent it to a couple of agents. And within 2 weeks, they'd come back to me and said that they were interested and they wanted to see the rest. And then they offered me a 2-book deal. So compared to a lot of other people, it was quite an easy ride.
And if you had one piece of advice to any aspiring author, what would that be?
Oh, I think read as much as you can. I don't understand writers that don't read, to be honest, because I read a lot and I learn more and more and more subconsciously without even realizing. The more you read, the more you soak up about sentence structure, about plot, about characterization. So just read as much as you can, as widely as you can.
Are you one of those writers who always has a notepad and pen in your bag just in case you hear a great piece of dialogue?
Yeah, well, I tend to have my phone, so the notes on my phone are full of completely random weird notes, things that I've heard while I'm out and about, and I thought, oh, I can use that, jot that down. I went to watch the boxing, the Anthony Joshua fight, and as I was stood watching the boxing, a scene for the book that I'm working on now popped into my head. So AJ is getting duffed up in the ring and I'm on my phone typing out a note of a scene that I want to write when I get home.
Well, there's an image I can't get out of my head. Lisa Hall, thank you so much for not only taking us deep into the woods and creeping me out last night, but also for some top tips to aspiring writers.
Thank you.
The Woman in the Woods joins Lisa Hall's other psychological thrillers in the R&IB library, thanks to the generosity of publisher HarperCollins.
Hello, my name is Louis Morehouse. I'm 19 years old and I'm currently at Leeds Beckett University studying music production. And my favourite audiobook at the moment is, well, it's technically 2 books, but it's Sound Pictures and Maximum Volume, both by Kenneth Womack. And they're basically the life story of Beatles producer George Martin. As a music production student, I like to learn from the greats, and George Martin was certainly one of the greats. These books are incredibly comprehensive, you know, they talk about all the gear that they were using at the time, all the amps and guitars and even how many takes they did on a certain day, and it's incredibly detailed. But that's the kind of thing that I really enjoy, especially when it comes down to talking about the specifics of the gear. The music producer in me really enjoys that. I like audiobooks because I feel like with a book, you have to sit down and commit to reading that book for half an hour or whatever it may be. And you have to imagine the voices in your head and, you know, what the characters sound like in a certain situation. But an audiobook, I feel like the audiobook brings the characters to life a lot more. They're given voices, and it just puts you in the situations that these characters are in a lot more. Especially if it's an audiobook where they've added music and sound effects. It can really help bring the scene to life in your head and really fuel the imagination. The other benefit of audiobooks as well is that you can be listening to them on the go and while doing other things. If, like I said about a book, you have to sit down and commit to reading that for half an hour and really get into the world, and, you know, then you'll get interrupted and you're suddenly sort of jerked out of that world. Whereas with an audiobook, it's more, you know, you can listen to it on the go while doing anything else with headphones on. You can listen to it all day long if you really want to. And I think that really helps to sort of keep you in the zone of the audiobook, even when you're doing other things.
Now it's back to Alison MacLeod for the books of her life.
Alison, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
There absolutely was, Red. Two close contenders. It was Little Women with the character of Jo, for obvious reasons, being the writer amongst the sisters. I am one of four sisters. But I would say, actually, the real book that just set me alight as a nine-year-old and continued for many years thereafter was Anne of Green Gables and the whole series of Anne of Green Gables books. You know, Anne was from the same part of the world as me, which I was growing up in Nova Scotia, which is where she was actually born. We traveled the island to Prince Edward Island, my family a great deal still. And she was a girl with a big imagination. And she also had a mischievous or even a slightly subversive side to her. She looked at the world differently. And that big imagination of hers really inspired me to think it could be a force in the world.
The long platform was almost deserted, the only living creature in sight being a girl who was sitting on a pile of shingles at the extreme end. Matthew, barely noting that it was a girl, sidled past her as quickly as possible without looking at her. Had he looked, he could hardly have failed to notice the tense rigidity and expectation of her attitude and expression. She was sitting there waiting for something or somebody, and since sitting and waiting was the only thing to do just then, she sat and waited with all her might and main. Matthew encountered the station master locking up the ticket office preparatory to go home for supper, and asked him if the 5:30 train would soon be along.
"The 5:30 train has been in and gone half an hour ago," answered the brisk official, "but there was a passenger dropped off for you, a little girl. She's sitting out there on the shingles. I asked her to go to the ladies' waiting room, but she informed me gravely that she preferred to stay outside. There was more scope for imagination, she said. She's a case, I should say."
Sarah Minnell, narrating Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery. And you can find the complete series in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, Red, I think on a rainy day, there is no book I would love more as my comfort read than Jane Eyre, for the beauty of its prose, for the passion of Jane Eyre, for the sort of honesty of her struggle, and for the strange, uncanny moments which move me still, those almost uncanny telepathic moments of connection between her and Rochester. So all of those things live in me still.
I was passing the back parlour, or teacher's sitting room, the door of which was half open, to go to the kitchen, when someone ran out. "It's her, I'm sure! I could have told her anywhere!" cried the individual, who stopped my progress and took my hand. I looked. I saw a woman attired like a well-dressed servant, matronly yet still young, very good-looking, with black hair and eyes and lively complexion. "Well, who is it?" she asked in a voice and with a smile I half recognised. "You've not forgotten me, I think, Miss Jane." In another second, I was embracing and kissing her rapturously. "Bessie, Bessie, Bessie!" That was all I said. Whereat she half laughed, half cried, and we both went into the parlour.
Lucy Scott, narrating Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
This might be predictable, and it probably is, but the book I have reread continually because of my work on tenderness is Lady Chatterley's Lover. And for anyone who hasn't yet read it and thinks it's just a bit of fluff or a bit of a light read or just a bit dirty or scandalous, I would say please go, because not only is it one of the most profound love stories of all time, it's a hugely moving and hugely intelligent anti-war novel as well that casts its light all the way forward to struggles today around class, around how we can live fully in this life. So I discovered it as a 16-year-old. I read it in one way, and going back and rereading it, particularly over the last year, you know, probably 6 to 10 to 12 times, I continually discovered new beauties within it.
Connie always had a foreboding of the hopelessness of her affair with Mick, as people called him. Yet other men seemed to be nothing to her. She was attached to Clifford. He wanted a good deal of her life, and she gave it to him. But she wanted a good deal from the life of a man, and this Clifford did not give her, could not. There were occasional spasms of Michaelis, but as she knew by foreboding, that would come to an end. Mick couldn't keep anything up. It was part of his very being that he must break off any connection and be loose, isolated, absolutely lone dog again. It was his major necessity, even though he always said, "She turned me down."
Richard Earthy, narrating Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Alison MacLeod, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
A complete joy, Red. Thanks very much, and thanks to your listeners.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sale, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.